A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's prompt this week lands on something that happened just hours ago, and it's the kind of story where the headline tells you the what, but none of the why. A Primeair Cargo 767, coming in from Puerto Rico, overran the runway at Miami International, went through the perimeter, and hit vehicles on the road beyond. 5 people died on the ground. Daniel wants to know how a landing becomes an overrun, what the physics actually are when 200 tons of aircraft decides it's not stopping, and what safeguards exist, specifically EMAS, those engineered aerostol beds at the end of runways. And underneath that, I think he's asking the harder question. Why isn't the safety engineering we already know how to build everywhere it should be?
The NTSB will take months with this one, and I want to be careful about what we don't know yet. But the shape of it's already familiar to anyone who spends time on runway safety data. A freighter, a wet runway, an airport where the usable stopping distance is constrained by what's beyond the fence.
So let's start with what we actually know about Miami, then pull back to the physics and the engineering that are supposed to stop this exact thing from happening.
The aircraft was a Boeing 767-300F, the freighter variant, operated by Prime Air, which is Amazon's cargo operation. It had departed Puerto Rico and was on approach to Miami International. The landing went long. The aircraft crossed the runway end, crossed whatever safety area existed, breached the perimeter, and struck vehicles on a road adjacent to the airport. 5 fatalities on the ground. The airport issued a ground stop, and the NTSB has launched a full investigation.
5 people in cars. That's the detail that separates an overrun from a near miss. The aircraft may have been at a survivable speed for the crew by the time it reached the road, but a 767 moving at even 40 or 50 knots is an unstoppable object for a sedan.
And that's the part the public conversation always gets wrong. A runway overrun isn't a landing that was a bit long. It's a catastrophic failure of the stopping process. The aircraft arrives at the threshold with an enormous amount of kinetic energy, and the runway's entire job is to convert that energy into heat and drag until the aircraft is stationary before the pavement ends. When that conversion fails, the airport boundary stops being a fence and becomes a hazard zone.
So let's talk about the energy first, because everything else follows from it. A 767 at landing speed, call it 140 knots, with a landing weight somewhere north of 130,000 kilos. Do the math on that.
Kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared. At 140 knots, that's roughly 72 meters per second. Square that, multiply by the mass, and you're looking at something on the order of 350 megajoules. To put that in perspective, that's the energy equivalent of about 80 kilograms of TNT. Not an explosion, but a quantity of energy that has to go somewhere. The brakes, the spoilers, the reverse thrust, the rolling resistance of the tires, all of it exists to bleed that energy off as heat and drag over a few thousand feet of pavement.
80 kilos of TNT. So when we say the aircraft failed to stop, we're really saying the runway ran out of room to absorb the energy, and the surplus got spent on whatever was past the end.
And the stopping distance is a function of a few variables. You've got the braking force available, which comes from wheel brakes, reverse thrust on the engines, and the spoilers killing lift so the weight actually sits on the wheels. Then you've got the friction coefficient between the tires and the runway surface. Dry concrete gives you a coefficient around 0.4 to 0.5. Wet concrete drops that. Standing water introduces hydroplaning, where the tire is literally riding on a film of water and not touching the runway at all. In hydroplaning conditions, the friction coefficient can fall below 0.1. Your stopping distance triples, quadruples, sometimes more.
And a wet runway isn't a rare edge case. It's a Tuesday. Airports in Florida deal with standing water constantly. The question isn't whether the runway was contaminated, it's how much, and whether the braking action reports matched reality.
There's another factor people don't think about, rubber buildup. Every landing deposits a thin layer of rubber on the touchdown zone. Over days and weeks, that rubber accumulates and actually polishes the surface, reducing friction in exactly the spot where the aircraft first touches down. Airports have to run rubber removal operations, usually high-pressure water or chemical treatments, to keep the friction coefficient within acceptable limits. If that maintenance is behind schedule, the runway is slipperier than the pilots expect.
So the physics are unforgiving, but they're also predictable. Which means the real story of an overrun is usually upstream of the runway itself. It's in the decisions made in the cockpit and the conditions the crew was handed.
Right. And this is where the concept of landing distance available versus landing distance required becomes important. Before every landing, the crew is supposed to calculate, based on aircraft weight, runway condition, wind, temperature, and pressure altitude, how much runway they need to stop. That number gets compared to how much runway they actually have. The regulations require a safety margin. For a dry runway, the required distance is typically multiplied by 1.67, for a wet runway, by 1.92. The idea is that even if everything goes slightly wrong, the aircraft should still stop with runway to spare.
But those calculations assume the approach is stable. And unstable approaches are the leading cause of overruns. Too high, too fast, touching down deep into the runway instead of in the touchdown zone. Every knot of excess speed at the threshold adds meaningfully to the stopping distance because of that velocity squared term.
A knot is roughly half a meter per second, but the energy scales with the square. 10 knots fast at touchdown isn't 10% more energy, it's closer to 15% more. And if you touch down 1,000 feet past the threshold, you've simply removed 1,000 feet of runway from your stopping calculation.
The FAA has been pushing stabilized approach criteria for years. The idea is that by a certain point on final approach, typically 1,000 feet above the runway, the aircraft should be on speed, on glide path, configured for landing, and descending at a stable rate. If not, the crew is supposed to go around. Not think about it, not try to salvage it. Go around.
And that's where the human element gets complicated. Cargo crews fly at night, often in marginal weather, and they're under schedule pressure. A go-around costs fuel, time, and may disrupt the entire logistics chain downstream. Amazon doesn't want its packages late. The operator doesn't want the extra fuel burn. The crew knows all of this. There's a well-documented phenomenon called plan continuation bias, where a pilot who has flown for hours to reach a destination becomes psychologically committed to landing, even when the conditions argue for going around. It's not recklessness. It's a cognitive bias that aviation safety researchers have been studying for decades.
And cargo pilots don't have passengers complaining, but they also don't have the same regulatory scrutiny that passenger operations get. The hours can be brutal, the destinations are often secondary airports, and the aircraft are older. The 767 freighter fleet has been worked hard.
I want to be careful here. We don't know what happened in that cockpit. We don't know if the approach was unstable, if there was a mechanical issue, if the runway condition report was inaccurate, or if the crew made a judgment call that didn't work out. What we do know is that overruns are rarely a single failure. They're almost always a stack.
And that's the Swiss cheese model, which I know you love.
I do. James Reason's model, originally developed for healthcare actually, the idea is that every layer of defense has holes, like slices of Swiss cheese. Normally the holes don't line up. But when they do, the hazard passes through every layer and you get an accident. In an overrun, the layers are the approach, the touchdown point, the braking action, the runway length, the safety area, and then whatever is beyond the fence. All of them have to fail in sequence.
So let's talk about that safety area. The FAA mandates a runway safety area, an RSA, at the end of every runway. The standard is 1,000 feet beyond the runway end, and it's supposed to be clear of obstacles, graded, and capable of supporting an aircraft that overruns without collapsing the landing gear.
The RSA is a buffer, not a guarantee. It's often grass or compacted earth. A heavy jet moving at high speed will plow through it, but it'll slow down. The problem is that 1,000 feet isn't always available. At airports built before the modern standards, or airports squeezed by terrain, water, or adjacent development, the RSA may be shorter. In some cases, it's essentially non-existent. The runway ends, and then there's a fence, and then there's a road.
Miami International is exactly that situation. It's an older airport, hemmed in by urban development on all sides. Runway 9, which is the one involved in this incident, has a road running along the perimeter. The RSA is constrained. When the 767 went off the end, it didn't have 1,000 feet of grass to slow it down. It had whatever was there, and then it had the road.
And that's the direct link between a landing mishap and a multi-fatality ground collision. The energy that couldn't be dissipated on the runway or in the safety area gets spent on cars, trucks, buildings, people. The aircraft becomes a projectile. At the speed it was moving when it crossed the perimeter, even a glancing impact with the vehicle is lethal.
The 2016 Emirates 777 crash in Dubai is the same pattern. The aircraft landed long. The crew attempted a go-around too late, and the aircraft settled back onto the runway, overran, and caught fire. One firefighter died. The aircraft was destroyed. The energy had to go somewhere, and it went into the airframe and the fire.
That one was a go-around executed too late, which is its own category of failure. The aircraft was in the flare. The crew decided to go around, the engine spooled up, but the aircraft touched down anyway, and then lifted off again briefly before the gear retracted and it settled back down. By that point, it was too far down the runway to stop.
So we know why overruns happen. The physics are brutal, the margins are thin, and the human factors are real. The question Daniel asks next is, what's been done about it? And that's where EMAS comes in.
Engineered materials. Arresting systems. And I want to be precise about what they are because the name sounds more complicated than the concept. An EMAS bed is a stretch of lightweight, crushable concrete blocks installed at the end of a runway. The blocks are designed to collapse under the weight of an aircraft's landing gear. When the gear sinks into the material, the aircraft experiences enormous drag, and that drag brings it to a stop much faster than rolling through grass or dirt would.
So it's essentially a controlled crumple zone. The energy that would otherwise go into the fence, the road, the cars, gets spent crushing concrete blocks instead.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. The material is a specific formulation of lightweight aggregate with a honeycomb structure, and it's engineered to crush at a predictable rate. The FAA has a table of EMAS arrestments, and the system has stopped aircraft ranging from small business jets up to a 747. The most famous case is probably the 2016 incident at LaGuardia, where a 737 overran on a snowy runway and was stopped by the EMAS bed. No fatalities, aircraft substantially intact.
LaGuardia is the poster child for EMAS, because that airport is surrounded by water on three sides. There was never going to be a 1,000-foot RSA. The EMAS bed was the only thing between the runway end and Flushing Bay.
And that's the key point about where EMAS gets installed. It's not a universal feature, it's a mitigation for airports where the standard RSA can't be provided due to physical constraints. If you have the space for a full 1,000-foot safety area, you don't need EMAS. The grass and dirt do the job. But if you're hemmed in by water, terrain, or a road, EMAS is the engineered substitute for the space you don't have.
Which means the airports that need EMAS most are exactly the older, urban airports that were built before the modern standards. Miami, LaGuardia, Chicago Midway, Burbank. These are the airports where the runway ends and the city begins.
And Miami does have EMAS on some runways. The question that will come up in the investigation is whether the specific runway involved, Runway 9, had an EMAS bed, and if not, why not? Because if the runway was constrained enough that a 767 overrunning could reach a road, that's exactly the scenario EMAS exists to prevent.
Here's the uncomfortable part. EMAS is expensive. A single installation can run into the tens of millions of dollars. The blocks have to be replaced after an arrestment, and they degrade over time even without one. For an airport authority managing a budget, EMAS is a capital project that may never be used. It's insurance against an event that might happen once in 30 years.
The economics are brutal. Airports are funded through a mix of passenger fees, federal grants, and bond issues. The FAA has a program that helps fund EMAS installations, but it's competitive. An airport has to justify the expense, and the justification is essentially, this runway has a constrained RSA and heavy aircraft use it. The more traffic and the heavier the aircraft, the stronger the case. But smaller airports, regional airports, cargo-focused airports, they often fall through the cracks.
Cargo operations are growing. Amazon, FedEx, UPS, they're flying more freighters into more airports, often at night, often in marginal weather. The infrastructure at those airports may not have kept pace with the volume and the aircraft size.
The 767 freighter is a heavy aircraft. It's not a 747, but it's a lot of mass moving at a lot of speed, and it's being flown into airports that may have been designed for smaller aircraft 50 years ago. The safety regulations haven't kept pace with the growth of e-commerce logistics. That's a systemic gap, and it's one the NTSB will be looking at, not just in Miami, but across the whole cargo sector.
The Swiss cheese model applies not just to the individual accident, but to the system as a whole. The approach, the runway condition, the braking action, the RSA, the EMAS if it exists, the road beyond the fence. In Miami, the whole's aligned. And the question is whether they align because of bad luck, bad decisions, or bad infrastructure.
The NTSB will pull the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. They'll reconstruct the approach, the touchdown point, the braking action, the aircraft configuration. They'll look at the weather, the runway condition reports, the pilot's training and duty history. They'll map the aircraft's path across the runway end and into the road. And they'll issue findings and recommendations probably a year or more from now.
The recommendations will likely include something about EMAS, something about runway safety areas, something about cargo operations at constrained airports. The question is whether anyone will act on them.
That's the part that frustrates me. The NTSB has been recommending EMAS and improved RSAs for decades. The technology is proven. The FAA has data showing the system works. And yet, every few years, another aircraft goes off the end of a runway that didn't have the protection it needed. The gap isn't knowledge, it's money and political will.
There's a maintenance angle too, which I don't think gets enough attention. EMAS isn't a install-it-and-forget-it system. The blocks are exposed to the elements, to jet blast, to de-icing fluid, to rubber deposits. Over time, they can degrade. The crushability that makes them work can be compromised. If an EMAS bed isn't maintained, it might not perform as designed when it's finally needed.
That's a real concern. The FAA has standards for EMAS maintenance, and airports are supposed to inspect the beds regularly and replace damaged blocks. But again, that costs money, and it's easy to defer maintenance on a system that hasn't been used in years. The assumption is that it'll work when it's needed. The reality is that it might not.
We have a safety system that's proven, but expensive, installed only where space is constrained, and dependent on ongoing maintenance to remain effective. And the alternative, in too many places, is a fence and a road.
The road is the part that keeps me up at night. We've spent decades hardening aircraft and improving crew training, and the result is that accidents in the air have become vanishingly rare. But the ground is a different story. When an aircraft overruns, the people at risk aren't the crew, who are protected by the airframe and the seats and the belts. The people at risk are in cars, in buildings, on the street, with no protection at all.
The runway isn't the end of the journey. It's the last line of defense. When that line fails, the consequences are measured in lives lost on the ground, not in the air.
That's the thing I think Daniel was really asking about. The physics and the engineering are interesting, but the deeper question is about how we think about safety. We've gotten very good at preventing the crash. We've been much slower to invest in mitigating the consequences when the crash happens anyway.
The Swiss cheese model says accidents happen when the holes align. But the holes don't align by accident. They align because of decisions made years earlier about funding, about infrastructure, about where to put a road and whether to install a crushable concrete bed at the end of a runway.
Those decisions are invisible until the moment they're not. Nobody thinks about the runway safety area when they're driving past the airport. They think about it when a 767 comes through the fence.
Let's talk about what happens next. The NTSB investigation will take months. The preliminary report will come out in a few weeks, but the full picture won't be clear for a year or more. And the question is whether this incident changes anything.
The history of aviation safety is that change usually follows tragedy. The industry is reactive by nature. It's hard to justify spending millions on a system that might prevent an accident that might happen someday. It's much easier to justify the spending after the accident has already happened and the bodies have been counted.
That's the tragedy of the commons, isn't it? The airport authority that installs EMAS spends money now to prevent a future cost that's uncertain. The airport authority that doesn't install it saves the money and hopes the accident happens somewhere else.
The growth of air cargo makes this more urgent. More freighters, more flights, more airports, more night operations in marginal weather. The exposure is increasing, and the infrastructure in too many places hasn't kept up.
I think about the road beyond the fence at Miami. There were people driving home from work, picking up kids, running errands. They had no idea they were in the path of a 767. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the wrong place was a road that shouldn't have been that close to the end of a runway.
The road was there because the airport was built when the city was smaller and the city grew up around it. The runway was there first. The road came later. And now they coexist in a way that's dangerous. And the fix is expensive, and nobody wants to pay for it.
The EMAS bed, where it exists, is the compromise. It's the engineered solution to the problem of not having enough space. But it's not universal, and it's not free, and it's not permanent.
That's the honest answer to Daniel's question. The safeguards exist, they work, but they're not everywhere they should be, and the reasons are economic and political, not technical.
Well, I think there's one more layer to this, and I want to hear what Hilbert has to say.
I spent a summer in the late 90s doing quality control for a company that poured the concrete for an EMAS bed at a small regional airport in Ohio. The mix was specific. Lightweight aggregate, a particular density, a honeycomb structure inside the blocks. The foreman used to brag that the bed could stop a 747, which was funny because the biggest aircraft that airport ever saw was a regional turboprop. They tested it once with a runaway pickup truck. The truck sank in and stopped in about 40 feet. The foreman was very proud. The thing nobody talks about is that the material is basically giant blocks of styrofoam like concrete. It's designed to crush. But over time, it gets contaminated. Dirt, rubber, jet fuel, de-icing fluid. The contamination hardens the blocks. They stop being crushable. They turn into a solid slab. And a solid slab doesn't arrest anything. It just becomes an extension of the runway with a fence at the end. I wonder about Miami. If that runway had EMAS, was it up to spec? Or had it been sitting there for years, soaking up rubber and fuel, turning into something that looked like an arrestor bed but wasn't one anymore?
That's the maintenance gap. A safety system that's designed to be soft and crushable can become hard and useless over time, and nobody notices until it's needed.
That's the broader point. Safety isn't a one-time installation. It's a continuous process. The EMAS bed that was installed 20 years ago isn't the same EMAS bed today. The runway that was grooved for drainage 5 years ago has been polished by rubber since then. The safety area that was graded last year has been eroded by storms. Everything degrades, and the degradation is invisible until it matters.
The question isn't just whether the safeguard was installed. It's whether it was maintained, whether it was inspected, whether it was still doing its job on the day it was needed.
The FAA has inspection standards. But standards are only as good as the person doing the inspection, and the person doing the inspection is usually underpaid, overworked, and looking at a system that hasn't been used in years. It's easy to check the box and move on. I remember one inspection where we found a block that had been cracked by a snowplow. The airport manager said it was fine. The crack was cosmetic. We replaced it anyway because the whole point of the block is to crush predictably, and a cracked block doesn't crush predictably. But I always wondered how many other airports just left the cracked blocks in place.
That's the thing about safety systems. They're only as good as the willingness to maintain them. And maintenance is the first thing that gets cut when budgets are tight.
We have a system that works when it's installed correctly, maintained properly, and used as designed. And the failure modes are all human. The decision not to install it, the decision to defer maintenance, the decision to assume it'll work when it's needed.
The foreman in Ohio used to say that the EMAS bed was like a fire extinguisher. You hope you never need it, but if you do, you really need it to work.
A fire extinguisher that's been sitting in a corner for 20 years without inspection isn't a fire extinguisher. It's a red canister.
The NTSB will look at all of this. They'll look at the runway condition, the safety area, the EMAS if it existed, the maintenance records, the inspection history, and they'll find the holes in the cheese.
Then, they'll issue recommendations, and the industry will debate them, and some airports will act and others won't. And in a few years, there will be another overrun, and we'll have this conversation again.
Unless this time is different. The growth of air cargo is putting pressure on the system in ways that didn't exist before. More freighters, more flights, more airports, more exposure. The economics of safety might actually shift.
The most common misconception about runway overruns is that they're always caused by pilot error or mechanical failure. The reality is that they're almost always a combination of factors: an unstable approach, a contaminated runway, a constrained safety area, a missing or degraded arrestor bed. The pilot is one layer in a system, and the system failed.
The second misconception is that EMAS is standard equipment at major airports. It's not. It's an expensive mitigation used only where the standard safety area can't be provided. Many busy airports don't have it, and the runways that need it most are exactly the ones where it's hardest to install.
The investigation will take months. The question is whether the findings will translate into action or whether this becomes another statistic in the FAA's overrun database. The growth of air cargo means more aircraft flying into airports that may not be equipped for the worst-case scenario. The conversation has to shift from preventing the crash to mitigating the consequences when the crash happens.
The runway is the last line of defense. When that line fails, the people on the ground pay the price.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running and for the Ohio story.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com with your questions, your prompts, your corrections. We read everything.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.